All right. Yes. Yeah, so I work at a security company, and a lot of people want to know, well, how do you think about security, right? Just to kind of go over my background, Director of Platform Security at ThreatStack. Before I was in this role, I was doing computer security research, and I did many, many years of system administration. You can follow me on Twitter and for hilarious security content. So if you get nothing out of this talk, I want to drive home the idea that security requires context, right? So you cannot make a security decision without really understanding the landscape you're operating in and the stuff that you're trying to secure. I'm going to secure a safe with tens of dollars in it differently than I'm going to secure a donut shop. For those of you with security backgrounds, I look at this like threat modeling, but I think that when folks outside the security world hear threat modeling, there's a lot of different definitions of what that means. So I think the easiest thing to say is context, right? And so if we take that donut shop, for example, I totally did write this at a donut shop. We have this guy out on the outside. He is just staring at donuts, other baked goods, and he wants to, get the donut, right? The glass probably is effective here. As far as the donut shop itself, they probably care about making sure that the employees aren't taking money out of the till, that kind of thing. If we contrast that to what we do at ThreatStack, we make Audit D wonderful, right? So if you've never looked at Audit D's output for system calls and other audit events, it's this multi-line unparsable thing. So we make that really wonderful, right? So we collect these system calls, display them in our UI, and we pull in CloudTrail API logs, right? So given our context, I think a natural response to this is to say, well, you're securing important security data, so you need to be 100% secure all the time, ever. And I want to be clear, our margin for error is super, super thin. When I talk to people who are about to get production access or customer data access, this is kind of one of the things that I make extremely clear. At the same time, I want to acknowledge that a 100% system, 100% secure system doesn't exist, right? Like physics are real here. A 100% secure system requires changes all the way down the stack in ways that, as a smaller organization, we're not going to be addressed. And I don't mean like making Node.js or Scala more secure. I mean like we're going to have to go deep into the hardware, and think about how can we, handle multi-tenancy in a good way. And there are organizations with literal aircraft carriers full of cash that want to solve this problem, and we don't have an answer yet, right? So at our level, I only have so much time in the day, and I need to be able to prioritize. So I need to be cognizant of two things. One, the organization is going to want to go fast, right? One of the interesting things that I get to do is handle our pen test programs, our internal ones. And I was on a call with an analyst, and they said, you either get the software right or the company right. And if you don't get the last one correct, then you don't get the first one at all. So when you're building something new, you don't always have the ability to really do it or secure things the way that you'd want to. And for me, I want to secure all the things, right? So I want to be able to actually make sure that we're doing things in a safe way. And I think that's honestly the interesting bit where these two needs kind of intersect, right? That's usually where interesting things happen in general. So since we've launched and we've had customers and a product, we can now grow up and evolve, how we think about security in our organization. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the quick wins that we've made in the last couple of years to improve our platform, relate it back to things that you can possibly do to improve the hygiene of your platform, and give some general, bits of insight and thought on how to evolve this in the future. So I'm going to start with access control. This was one of my first projects for fixing at where we were at. We had named accounts for everybody, and that was all distributed with Chef, and that was fine and good. But it is a little bit challenging when you're small and there's not a lot of people. What do roles look like in that case? But even large organizations don't do a great job at access control. Think about how people transfer throughout organizations and end up going from, organization, group A to group B, without, they end up having a lot of access with them after they transition. So you know, this is one of the things that's important for us to figure out. And I think a natural place where folks do this is they do it front end versus back end, right? You have a group of folks that are working on front end stuff, they get access to the front end servers. You have folks working on your databases and your back end services, they do it on the back end side. They get access to the back end servers. But there are a lot of other places that you can do access control as well. When I looked at how we can start to separate out who has access to what, I took a look at, okay, well, we have Hyproxy and other front door services. Maybe not everybody needs access to those servers. Or, you know, of our RabbitMQ and Kafka machines, maybe only the folks that are doing back-end stuff that have a certain need to start poking around on those, they only need access to that. You know, same for state storage or anything like that. Splitting things like this up is helpful because at the end of the day, it actually makes onboarding safer. When I think of what we've been able to do and what we've been able to help people learn about our platform when they start, we've had a really good, it's been really easy for folks to get access to stuff without me having to worry about, okay, well, are they going to accidentally do the wrong thing in the wrong place? And so I joke tech of the 90s today scale, but we just implement this using LDAP. It's not anything special. We use PAM access and LDAP to make this happen. We like technologies that have been proven and that they work, and LDAP is one of those things. And also building tools that integrate with LDAP is pretty easy as well. So when I talk about tooling, you know, it is actually kind of fun to make some of this stuff come together, right? So when I look at some of the things that we've built to improve the security story at ThreatStack, I kind of put this in the three different categories. So we have a tool called Deputize. One of the things that we wanted to do is make it so that engineers, when they needed access or they were on call, they had access to the stuff that they were able to, that they needed, right? We don't want to give engineers access to everything all the time. So we were able to actually wire up PagerDuty, LDAP, and Slack so that when somebody is on call in PagerDuty, this process goes out, checks the PagerDuty schedule, and then sets the on-call group in LDAP, which will give them access to more stuff. Similarly, instead of letting people use whatever SSH key that they want, we actually store SSH keys, or we actually use YubiKeys to SSH into all of our infrastructure. And we store that public key in LDAP using a little tool called AuthKeys. So this will actually replace an authorized keys file so that our users can't actually go in and add their own insecure SSH key. So we also no longer need to push this out across every machine. Similarly, we have a little thing called VPN Notify that sends you a message when you actually connect to a VPN. We have a customizable message template for that too. These are all things that we've built and we have on github.com/threatstack/the tool name. Switching gears, credential theft, not a new problem. So I always enjoy kind of going on github.com sometimes and typing in like XOXP or XOXB and seeing what kind of secrets that you'll find in various various repositories. If you've read anything about credential theft, the really popular story is CodeSpaces. There are other examples of people's AWS bill that has been ruined by credential theft as well. Bots actually go and search GitHub for various credentials, and then we'll actually use them to mine Bitcoin because the easiest way to get rich off of Bitcoin is to not use your own resources to do so. Right. So we had to start and think about how we wanted to do dynamic secrets. Right. One of the things that made it really easy for us to bring something like Vault into our infrastructure was that we wanted to get away from people having their own long-lived static AWS credentials on the jump host. Vault is a complex system in that I think it allows you to do anything that you want to do. And so there's no opinionated way to actually set it up. But what we found is that when we started getting people short-lived credentials, we were able to really have that win there. So we started building tooling around Vault as well. So when we look at, you know, how we can actually get credentials out of Vault, you know, we can do this crazy dance of, you know, running Vault auth and then Vault read and then writing that file or writing the credentials to .aws credentials. Or what we did was we made tooling that would make it easy for folks to get on with their life and just run one command, which we called Mr. Manager, and get, you know, continue on. So one of these things that I think that we get wrong in the security field is we don't focus enough on the user experience for these kind of tools. There's a lot of tooling that you can make in your own infrastructure that will make the secure way the easy way. Cryptography. So I think that it's a fairly well-known statement to not write your own crypto. But what was really, really interesting is that there are plenty of bad ways to implement other people's crypto as well. A friend of mine worked in a prop shop, and he actually brought me into this room full of knives and guns. And it was one of those experiences where it's just like, wow, there's so much bad stuff in here that it's very easy to hurt yourself, right? And I always looked at cryptography kind of the same way. So, you know, this is a conversation we got to have recently with one of our consultants where I kind of said, okay, well, we're looking to secure this kind of data and we should probably use some sort of crypto, right? And my friend, that's what she does. So we started having a conversation and digging into, okay, well, what are the right settings to use for this data? How should we actually store this? What are the right ciphers and whatnot? But, you know, then she came back and said, well, you know, it's really interesting. I hope that you're rotating your keys if you're storing more than 4 billion documents, because otherwise then I can start to derive the actual key for that data, which is not something that I would have known off the top of my head, but it turns out is a real thing. It's hard to find cryptographers to work with, unless you work with a consulting company. But, you know, fostering connections with local universities, you might be able to find somebody who is willing to take money in exchange for cryptography advice. Actually, you know, I want to go back to that. You know, we started evaluating protocols for doing API stuff, too. So it's not necessarily just how am I securing data, but it can also be, great, how are we looking at authentication for an API? Do we want to just use an API key? Do we want to, you know, how do we want to handle authentication? And so protocol analysis is something else that these folks can help out with and be extremely useful. So I think compliance gets a bad rap. I think that we have a tendency to look at compliance as a checkbox exercise that, you know, we go through the checkbox exercise and then next year we get out Excel and go through the checkbox exercise again. But every once in a while you get to get some wins for compliance and security at the same time, and they can lead to better outcomes. Recently we had to go through a SOC 2 type 2 evaluation. You know, we had a requirement to make sure that our code was ready to go to production, you know, when we were actually shipping stuff. We have a lot of tickets, and so we wanted to be able to say, give people the power to merge their own code into production, and use Jira as a way to make sure that it was, you know, somebody else had reviewed it and approved it. So we actually wrote a small tool that's, I think we're going to open source it eventually, that was able to take that kind of output from a merge request and actually go through, look at all the tickets that were referenced, and then tell you what state they were in. So, you know, this is kind of a basic view of that, but we actually added in some graphics and all that too to let you know if it was approved or not, which is a lot of fun. Similarly, and actually I haven't even brought this into the office yet, but you know, we were talking about chaos engineering a little bit. We have a little chaos engineering service of our own. And one of the interesting things, when I had started making this you know, kind of chaos process, folks were really hesitant. So we were, I was saying, okay, we're going to start to terminate hosts that have had manual commands run on them. And so there were a lot of questions. People were really uneasy. But at the same time, I could start telling them the value of it. So last week, I decided, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to flip this on its head a little bit. This isn't going to necessarily be a security thing. This is going to be a office event that we turn it into, you know, there's a button in a very fancy-looking case that will actually invoke the chaos action. We can't necessarily put our node termination thing into automated mode right now. So what we're going to do is kind of work towards that on a weekly basis. And so this was kind of a arts and crafts project in which I bought a IoT button and a Pelican case to make it feel really official when somebody was going to hit the button on Thursdays at 11 a.m. So this is kind of a fun way to bring kind of compliance together, but also turn the chaos event into an office event as well. And so now I have told people that this is going to happen, and they're like, oh, well, who gets to do the button first and all of that, which is super exciting, right? So I've talked a lot about a lot of stuff that we've done. I think the bigger question is, so where do you start, right? We started really small. I mean, maybe implementing LDAP isn't small, but we started small in the sense that this was a known problem that we knew that we had a solution to, and you know, we started there. You're not going to get to the destination that you want to get to overnight. I know that starts. I know that sounds obvious, but everybody has to start somewhere. I was thinking last week about what makes the team that I work on special, and one of the things that makes us kind of unique, and it kind of revolves around the way that we do work. Myself and my colleagues sit with the ops team, so we are there using their tools, using their infrastructure, using the same resources the same way. We deploy our tools to prod and other environments, and we use Chef to deploy infrastructure. In a market where skills are kind of hard to find, I think everybody wins when you start thinking about how to bring those teams together. Security learns how ops works, ops learns how security works, and you bring your devs into that cycle, and you start really having a good time. Tooling for automation is super important. I think automation is a force multiplier, and if you're going to implement security technology, finding a way to make it easier for the end user is how you get your wins. If you make a complex system that's hard to use, people aren't going to use it. Similarly, if you want people to use the systems that you make them make libraries, make that glue, because otherwise people aren't going to use it. Lastly, figure out your context. So I talked about what worked for us, right? Maybe your security model, maybe your context is not what we do, and that's fine. Maybe you can wait on the things that we started to implement really early. Figure out that threat model or context and figure out what changes it. What events will permanently change it, right? And what events will temporarily change it. I always think it's really interesting how much more spam email or actually phishing email that we get around fundraising. That may be a temporary change to your threat model. And with that, I have had time to take some questions.
Rick Farrow. So you notice what you're doing is you're using LDAP to control by controlling SSH credentials when people can log in. Mm-hmm. Do you terminate logins when somebody goes off duty?
Oh, that's an interesting one. So I think because of our size, we don't do that, but I can see a place where that would make sense. So, you know, you're talking about when somebody is basically not on call, they can't log into those servers?
Or? No, more like they SSH in and they never log out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is certainly a problem. I don't have a solution to that yet.
Yeah, because they might still be working, or maybe
right.
they just forgot, or maybe they have, honorary intentions. Who knows?
Yeah, I think the thing there is, so our on-call rotation is week to week. So they'd have to really leave that on for a while, but certainly not impossible, and that's a good point.
Yeah, there was the R-shell hijacking way back when Mitnick did the attack, and so
yeah,
just things to think about. Anyway,
yeah, makes sense. Thank
yeah,
you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.